4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55
Primates
million.
Appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural Revolution.
Civilization.
Industrial
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in a new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we're going to be featuring an interview with historian Richard White. Stay with us.
My name is Judy Burr. I'm an Earth Systems and Philosophy double major, and I'm interviewing Richard White.
Well, and why did you choose Richard?
Richard is someone I've been wanting to get to know a bit better for a while because I have been an intern at the Bill Lane Center for the American West, of which he is one of the faculty directors. And so I know John really well, who's another...
John Christensen?
Yeah. Okay. But I had never gotten a chance to interact with Richard, and he's always been like a very interesting person to hear from at like, all the meetings I've been to. And
just in terms of public speaking?
In terms of the way he comments on things, he always takes the critical view. I'd say it was brave, but he does it so consistently that it just seems to be like an awesome part of who he is.
What have you been doing with that internship? What does the internship involve?
Yeah, I started working at the Bill Lane Center over the summer last summer, and I started doing research on fire in California and Australia, specifically the way indigenous communities use fire and the way that they're interacting with land management agencies to put more controlled burns on the ground. And so that's been really interesting research that came out of some of the Bill Lane Center's work.
So you've prepared a bunch of questions for Richard. Is there a question that you're most excited about asking him?
I think I'm most excited about hearing what it was like to write about his own family, because he must have a very interesting look on the world just from being a historian and doing the kind of writing that he does. And I think it must have been kind of much different to be looking at his own past in terms of the stories that his mother told him versus the facts of history as he's usually taken them from archive documents and things like that. And I got some of that flavor from the introduction of that book that I did read, but I want to hear him talk about it.
The class is all about the Anthropocene. I'm wondering what that term means to you and where you would place the boundary.
The more and more of this research that I've done, the more I think the opinion that humans have been impacting the environment for thousands and thousands of years is something that's not out there enough. So if I had to place the boundary of the Anthropocene anywhere, I'd probably place it at least much, much further back, like give Native Americans some credit for all the changing that they did to the environment here, because I think that it's more and more I'm realizing something that's not as recognized. And I definitely didn't recognize it before I started doing the research that I do.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to your interview.
Great. Me too.
You're now going to hear the interview Judy conducted with Richard White. Following her interview, I continue the conversation with Richard. We talked about Generation Anthropocene's longing to have the same claim on history as his generation. How should we define our historical moment? Let's get to Judy's interview.
Well, here we are with Richard White. Richard White is the Margaret Barn Professor of American History here at Stanford and one of the faculty co-directors of the Bill Lane Center for the American West and the recent author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of the Modern America. Thank you, Richard, for being here.
I'm glad to be here, Judy.
And so I thought I'd start off by asking, as an environmental historian, if you could talk a little bit out of what environmental history is and what is the role of people in kind of the history of the environment.
Okay. Environmental history is a kind of discipline. It's a sort of one-trick horse that what happens is when people say nature, environmental historians say culture, and when people say culture, environmental historians say nature. And that's pretty much what we do. What it's about is looking at the ways in which when we see the world and human beings being involved in it, human beings never act alone. There's always a natural element in what they do. And when we look at nature as it actually affects human history, nature is rarely autonomous. It's always implicated in things human beings are doing in the world. So it's looking at the interrelationships between the two.
Do you start with nature or do you start with people, I guess? Is it more of people affecting nature?
Well, actually, there's when we do environmental history, because it's human, there's no beginning. The there is always there. As soon as you come into it, you find human beings, in fact, are affecting their environment. And human beings are living in a natural world, which is made up of weather, geological changes, animals, all of the things that have always affected human life. So there's no beginning. I mean, you can begin, I guess, before there were humans, but that wouldn't be environmental history. The history part demands humans.
So I guess you've written a lot about, I'm thinking of The Organic Machine and of your essay, Are You an Environmentalist or Do You Work for a Living?, of the changing relationship between people and nature and work. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The way I look at these things is that they're... In most of human history, the major way that humans related to nature was they worked in nature. They make a living by altering nature. They make a living by killing animals. They make a living by plowing the earth and putting seeds in the ground. They make a living by cutting down trees and boring into mountains for shelter. That there's never been a time where, in fact, this kind of intimate tie between human life and the natural world hasn't been present. What's happened with modernity is there's a way in which we get removed from all of this, that we can sit in a room like we're sitting in now and think that we're pretty much utterly removed from nature, and that most of us have jobs where what we do is what I'm doing right now. I talk for a living. But what we don't realize is those connections now might be less obvious, but they're still there. The light in this room is coming from a dam, most likely, that is harnessing a river, which is changing the flow, which is altering the habitat for other creatures. Virtually everything in this room is made out of one natural element or another that's been modified. Those ties are always there. So one of the things I try to point out is that even though many people now think that they're utterly removed from nature in the way that they earn their living and the way they live, and they think of those who work in nature, people who still farm or cut trees, is really a minority in a country like the United States. That's just not true. I mean, there's distances between them, but we're all implicated in the natural world.
Right. But how's that relationship? You've written about how dramatically it's changed from the different kinds of work that we've done to today, where we can still be implicated, but we're sitting in a room and we're talking, it does feel so different from...
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of innocence. There's, for example, very often you will see environmentalists or people, very often urban environmentalists, who will denounce hunters, let's say, who will denounce fishermen, who will denounce timber workers as people who are ruining the environment without having any sense that, in fact, the things they're doing probably have a greater impact on the environment than people who are acting on it directly. You know, that anybody who's lived in rural America, even lived in urban America, deer, for example, and you know, my neighborhood are pretty much overrunning the whole neighborhood. There's no predation anymore except automobiles. And it's not as if there aren't going to be times where deer are going to starve. They're not, you know, they're not pets. There's this kind of natural relationship. And to condemn people who shoot deer and who do it in a way that, in fact, keeps populations under control and who use the animals they kill, I regard those hunters as having a far more intimate connection with the natural world than many of the people who denounce them.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think that's often a frustration with environmentalists, as you've written about. But I, when I was up in the Klamath, I was talking with a man, Frank Lake, who is a member of the Karuk Indian tribe, and he was talking about his experience meeting with an environmentalist who was horrified that they were killing this specific species of bird for a sacred ritual, saying this bird is almost endangered. Like, how could you do this? And it did seem to be from this huge disconnect, her completely misunderstanding what the purpose was. And it was very frustrating to Frank.
Well, when I was first involved in Native American issues was actually one of the first times I was involved in environmental issues, and it was over salmon fishing in Puget Sound. And there, the Sierra Club actually came out against Indian fishermen because, in fact, those runs were at that time endangered. And it's perfectly true the runs were endangered, but it's also perfectly true they were not endangered because of the Indian fishermen. They were endangered because of far more powerful economic interests who the Sierra Club didn't take on. They took on Indians because they were at the end of the line. I think there can be, for me, you know, environmental problems have to always be involved with social justice problems. Otherwise, things go haywire very, very quickly.
How do you solve, like, what solutions can you propose to a situation like that where the fish is endangered and the Native Americans have this long history of both injustice and a relationship with the fish?
Yeah, well, in this case, what I found is that it's a lot easier to work with Indian tribes than it is to work with either environmentalists or the government. Indians are full well. They've known these fish for a long time. When I was in Puget Sound, and many of the controversies that I've been involved in since then, Indian fishermen are the first ones to point out the fish are declining. This is not a mystery. You will often hear white fishermen in these cases say the fish aren't declining. The fish, in fact, have just gone away, that people shouldn't intervene. So, in fact, I found that, you know, Indian peoples have tended to be more reasonable than many whites on this. And environmentalists often don't think of this as a sort of pristine run. Indians are more than willing to realize, well, the time has come where we might have to resort to other kinds of strategies. What they ask for is that they be compensated for their loss until the runs are brought back. So I've never seen them continue to fish totally endangered runs. They don't do that. It's not that Indians are perfect. They're not. But in fact, precisely because there is this long attachment and precisely because very often their ways of life depend on this, they are the most eager to bring them back. But there is a controversy. I mean, there are no easy solutions to this. Once you push a species to the brink of extinction, most of your options are off the table.
Right. And it's interesting that it almost becomes this dichotomy of when you think environmentalists, you do think whites and Indians who are closer to the fish and to the land. And it's interesting that whites / environmentalists have this aversion to intervention or to, like, very deep involvement in the land. And it does seem to stem from these historical patterns.
Sure. You know, I think there's in modern environmentalism, this sense that what you're dealing with is a pristine world, which if you leave it alone, it will revert back to this perfect balance, is precisely a factor that they don't intervene and they don't actually live in that world except as in recreation and leisure. Precisely because they've lost the contact through work, they're able to imagine that when you go into a national park, you're seeing an untouched landscape. You're seeing nothing of the sort. You're seeing an historical landscape, which has been brought back into being precisely because you've instituted certain management patterns. And once you remove yourself from it, you begin to think this is pure nature, which will operate as long as you keep human beings from intervening in it. It's really hard to imagine how you can condone human beings who you think are messing it up by simply acting as being human beings. But what you've done is you've invented a world. It's a fantasy world. It's a world which hasn't existed in the United States for a very long time. And I would say now, particularly with global warming, doesn't exist any place in the world. We have now touched virtually everything except maybe some of the deepest parts of the ocean.
Why does that myth continue to persist if it seems like as soon as you look back in history, it's obvious that there were people here and there was no pristine wilderness per se?
Because I think human beings need something outside of themselves. They need something as a standard of value, that the world becomes a very, very scary place if, in fact, you think all there is us and what we've done. I think it's why religious people believe in God, that there's a standard out there, something greater than them that'll intervene. And I think what's happened for a lot of environmentalists is this sort of untouched natural world has become the equivalent. There's a set of rules which can't be broken, which can't be violated. If you observe them, everything will turn out right. And in many ways, it's a deeply comforting belief. And I think that's why it's so attractive.
I'd like to read a quote. This was from one of your interviews with David Kennedy about Railroaded. And you were talking about the Western mythos of robber barons and the Oregon Trail. And you said, You can demythologize the West all you want. You won't get at the heart of these stories. Any set of stories that can have the power that those stories have, it's my feeling as a historian, it makes no difference if they're true or not. They become their own truths. What happens here is that people themselves begin to live according to these kinds of mythic strictures. These stories are really about, not so much the West, they're about America. They are about this sense that you can reimagine yourself, you can begin again. There's a place you can go that's untouched. You can be the first person there. It begins to encapsulate this whole set of hopes. And so when I heard that, it was just such an interesting commentary of the power of myth. And I immediately thought of this, like, myth of pristine wilderness that seems to permeate our lives in a harmful way, but that it seems quite different from these other myths that we draw hope from, especially in the context of our American history. Do you see those differences?
I see the belief in nature and this belief in the mythic West as being ones that are very, very close. It's one of the things that used to bother me when I was younger, because in fact, I don't think I entirely ever succumbed to that. So I'd be backpacking with friends, and we'd be in wilderness areas, and they'd be fantasizing that they're the first human beings who have ever touched this, and this is what it looked like 150 years ago, and I'd be thinking, you're nuts. It's beautiful. I mean, I want to protect it, but this is not. You haven't walked back into the past. You haven't reached an untouched nature. But at the same time, you know, as I say in that quote, I've lost any illusion I'm going to convince anybody to give up those beliefs. Those beliefs serve great and deep psychological functions for them, and they're not totally bad things. I mean, if in fact it takes that to make people believe that you need some parts of the world should be protected, and that, you know, you're not exploited for economic gain by humans, that's fine. If it means, in fact, that you start dictating to people who have lived in these landscapes for a very long time that they now have to conform to your beliefs, then I start having a great deal of problems with it.
Right. When do you think you first came into that understanding of wilderness, I guess, and that comment about, like, to your friends, when do you think that dawned on you and that you understood that?
You know, it started when I was doing my dissertation at the University of Washington, and I asked a really simple question. I wanted to know why in the Puget Sound area there were natural prairies. Why aren't there trees growing here when trees seem to grow every place, which isn't underwater in Puget Sound? And I started going up to the forestry school, and I started talking to ecologists. And because they were good foresters and good ecologists, began to dawn on me, they did not have the slightest idea. They had a whole series of reasons, all of which were plausible, but they were also mutually contradictory. And what I began to realize is, at least in some of those places, there were no trees because of human actions that had taken place a long time ago. And once I had that breakthrough, I began to see all the ways in which human actions had taken place. I remember reading the first surveyors going through the forests in Puget Sound, and large tracts of the forest had been burned over. This wasn't a seen untouched forest, and that very often the places that had been burned over and the trees were dead were near Indian villages. And then I began to realize that Indian peoples were setting fires as a land management technique all over the place, and so one thing leads to another. And I always began to suspect, until shown otherwise, that in fact there had been human activity on this land, and the activity had had consequences.
I'm currently taking conservation biology, so kind of thinking harder about what conservation biologists are aiming for when they're looking at a landscape and saying, okay, we want to conserve it in this way or try to preserve this or that environment. And it just strikes me as this incredibly confusing and, like, almost necessarily incorrect process. And I always just have no idea what that aim should be. And it seems like, just even as foresters, yes, we have to be involved and we have to act in the world. But it seems like necessarily if we have this illusion that we can control everything, it just seems to lead down this path where we feel like we're failing at our attempts to conserve or preserve certain ecosystems.
Well, the class has actually taught you a lot. Because at a certain point, we have to accept we're going to fail. We're not going to succeed completely in what we want, because what we want is everything. For example, you know, very often you have these conservation plans, or you used to anyway, which would say what we want to do is we want to preserve this as a wild area, whatever that means. But also, we don't want it invaded by exotic species, so we have to intervene here. And what we want to do is maintain certain animal populations, but that means we better suppress other animal populations. And before you know it, you're doing what you always do. You're intervening right and left. And what you're intervening for is a quite specific end. What you have to decide is you can't have everything. And it's become even more complicated now because with global warming, what's going to happen is places are going to change. I mean, keeping them in stasis even for a human lifetime is probably going to be out of the question.
Do you see any examples from history of like the impacts of human intervention? And I guess even in thinking about a situation like this, do you try to be informed by like actions of like past actions of humans?
I do. And it's not been a whole history of failure in the United States for the last 100, 150 years. There's been a lot of them. But where I used to teach at the University of Utah, if you go up in the Wasatch Mountain Range or even parts of the Uintas, 100 years ago, that was a ravaged landscape. It had been ravaged by mining. It had been ravaged by timber cutting. There was heavy erosion. The water supply was in danger. That's been a landscape that, by and large, has been restored. You have a much healthier set of ecosystems right next to Salt Lake City, which is also providing water in Salt Lake City. So those things have actually worked out. You can point it to large areas of the West where we know what to do to achieve a certain end, and we can do it. The problem is history keeps always catching up with us. I mean, that's where global warming again becomes the point which we do these things, but meanwhile there's this massive storm gathering on the on the horizon. Actually, it's not gathering; it's on us already. So we're going to have to act, and we're going to do some things, and some of those things we're going to get wrong. But there, we can learn an awful lot from the things that we have done right. But again, as I keep stressing, we can't have everything, which means that in some level we are going to be playing God. We're going to be setting a set of priorities, moving towards one set of ends, which is going to mean that other things are going to suffer.
And do you think we're learning? Do you think we are doing a good job, or?
Well, you know, it matters, you know, this becomes a who's the we here kind of, kind of question. You know, the current political attacks on global warming science are, to me, both predictable but also kind of astonishing, because there does seem to be this belief among certain sectors, some of which I can understand, some of which I can't, that there are no real consequences to these actions. And it's always very hard. I mean, if you're raising a child, it's one of the first things you know. The dawn of reason is when you realize you do something, certain things follow. And there's a certain relief as a parent when they begin to realize, whoa, this was my fault. I could have predicted that. And you'd like to think that the whole public has reached the stage of reason, but sometimes you listen to political debates and I begin to question that belief. So there are real issues here. I think one of the things we haven't learned to do is talk about this politically.
And when do we reach that breaking point where people care? Well, people care. It's polls have proven that people care. But how do they make that translate into actions?
Well, I think you have to offer people some kind of choice. One of the things that happens, if in fact you have an economy in a free fall, and you have people who are having trouble making a living, and you have increasing disparities of wealth between the rich and the poor, and then as most people, more and more people feel economically desperate, and then they're told they're going to face $1.50 more in gas, they're going to rebel. But your core problem here is that, as I've said, environmental problems and social problems and economic problems can't be disentangled. Unless you have some kind of basic security for people that they feel they can make sacrifices without endangering their well-being and the well-being of their children, by and large, they're going to rebel against making them. So it can be cast as an issue in which rich environmentalists who can afford to pay $1, $1.50 more for gas are forcing this on other people who really have reached really desperate circumstances, losing their homes, their jobs, and other things. For me, the focus is really clear. If environmentalists are serious about this and they want public support, they've got to hit those other problems too. I mean, you can't detach environmentalism from social justice and push it forward as its own solution.
I'd like to ask you more about your kind of beginnings in history. When did you decide to study study history, and were there kind of influential people along the way that drove you towards this environmental focus?
Well, you know, I only became a history major. This is terrible because they asked me to the sophomore college dinner, which is to encourage people to declare their majors by the end of sophomore year. Nobody bothered to tell me why I was there. So I was talking to the students at the table, and they asked how I declared my major, and it was senior year, and I was going to graduate, and it was December, and they told me I had to have a major. They weren't going to let me graduate, so I counted up my credits, and I had about roughly the same credits in English and history. Then I went to each department and asked them who was going to waive the most requirements I had left, and it turned out to be history, and I became a historian. So I'm not a very good poster child for how you choose a career. But having said that, I had so many history credits because there were terrific historians when I went to UC Santa Cruz. And, you know, one in particular who's still alive, John Dezikas, who was a tremendous influence. I mean, what he was is somebody who would take me seriously, disagree with me, and always make me think harder about things than I ever had had to do so before, and also made me admit that there could be people on another side of a question who actually had some pretty good arguments. He was very good at doing that.
It seems like maybe English and history both have that commonality of making you think really hard about a lot of conceptual problems. Is that, could that be like a general trend?
It's a general trend, but it's also the necessity of how human beings express themselves, how human beings make sense of the world. Because what history is pretty much a sense-making. It takes a set of disparate facts and it turns them into stories. What historians are, by and large, are storytellers. We're disciplined storytellers. We have real rules for telling stories, and you violate those rules and other historians will attack you. But essentially, in the end, we are people who tell stories about the past in a way that's supposed to be meaningful to our own society.
Right. And I thought it was interesting, too, that you had just finished that book, Remembering Anagram.
A Hanagram.
But especially reading just kind of your introduction to that book and talking about the tension between story and history. I guess, can you speak to that a little bit? How was that different than like writing a book about railroads?
Well, I mean, in some ways it's similar, but this is a book which tries to come to grips with my mother's stories about her childhood, her immigration to America, and her marriage to my father. And my own recreation of that by using historians' tools and historians' sources. And what I began to realize as I did the book and the way I ended up phrasing it is that people think that history is a kind of collective memory, but it's far from being that. That what I say in the book is history is the enemy of memory. Because what memory is about, and we all know this, it's sorting through our past to make a coherent version of who we are now. And we change our stories constantly. And we can do it in a way that you're not allowed to do in history. We can drop facts, disguise facts, change facts. And my mother would be perfectly willing to do all of these things in order to present a coherent version of herself. And I knew this because I'd been taping stories my mother had told me, because mostly for our children, but you know, for other reasons too, when I was thinking of the book. And so I could compare what she'd said, and these are different stories. She changed them over time because she'd grown to be a different person. Well, what history does is recreates the past too, but you change things, you drop things, there are other historians to catch you. And so for my mother, when I began to treat her stories as history and point out all the changes, all the things she did, it was not just that history was an enemy of memory. For a while, I was the enemy of her. I mean, she was really upset about a lot of this stuff, and actually confused, too, because what memory does is you not only disguise it, but you don't even realize you're disguising it. You mask it even to yourself. So it was a really interesting process, and one of the things that made me realize is how cruel my profession is, because what I do is very often attack people's most deeply held versions of themselves and of their past. And that's what I do for a living. And it can be really sort of nasty work, but at the same time, there's a sort of professional code that's my job. I think there's a real social utility that comes out of trying the best we can to follow a set of rules to open a window onto a past that you can't get any other way.
Do you think one of those pasts is more real in thinking of both history and memory as being ways to make sense of your world.
We both need both of them. And it's not as if by being a historian I have no memory. I mean, one of the things that was embarrassing to me was a moment of temptation. I have a version of my relationship with my father in the 1960s. And after I moved to Stanford, I was sorting some boxes that I hadn't opened for years. And I found letters my father wrote me in the mid-1960s, which were totally at variance of my memory of him, because my memory of him was that I was right, he was wrong, I knew what was going on, and he was just, totally stubborn and callous. These letters, he's pretty understanding. I mean, actually, so my own version of this part of my past was suddenly thrown in my face, and my first reaction was what many people do, destroy the letter and let my memory go on. I said, no, I can't do that. I just folded it up and put it back in there. I'm as subject to this as anybody else.
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting tension between trying to understand your past and your memory through the memories of relationships you've had, and while engaging in this nasty profession of objective fact and history. Is that how you think of it as you're writing these books?
What I try to remember when I'm writing the books, that when I say things that to me seem simply the results of my research are certainly attacks on other people's most deeply held beliefs. And I find that out all the time because I get nasty mail fairly regularly that begins to come in on this. But the shoe can turn. There was an old colleague, we actually went to graduate school together, Sherry Smith, is writing a book which she's calling Indians and the Counterculture. So it's the relationship between Indian peoples and left-wing radicals and hippies in the 1960s and 1970s. And one of the places she's focusing on is Frank's Landing, where the fishing rights demonstrations took place. And she knew I was there. And she asked if I'd talk about it. And I said, well, I'll talk about it, but I'll only give you just my memories. And she said, well, do you have anything that was written at the time? And I was about to say no. Then I realized soon after that time, I wrote what amounts to a really terrible novel. And the reason it was a terrible novel is that everything was what took place. I just changed the names. So it was a pretty good account of what had gone on. But at the same time, when I read it, I think this is, I've determined one thing by this. I'm not going to be a writer of fiction because I can't do conversations. But when I thought about it as a historical source, it was pretty good. But then I thought, is this how I want to present myself to the world, the way I was when I was 19 or 20, saying the kinds of things I said? And I thought, well, I'm a historian. I mean, it's just bad karma. I don't do this, I'll never get to see a source again. So I gave it all to Sherry and had her do it. So there are times where I move to the other side of the table and I understand how uncomfortable it can be.
Right. You just kind of live with that tension.
Yeah.
It sounds like you write about, you still want to frame them as being these three-dimensional.
Well, I have to. It's what I tell my students. I mean, the hardest thing for students taking a history class is that everybody they're reading about, these people were as alive as you were, as fully human as you are, as consumed with all the kinds of desires and fears as you are, had the same kinds of ambitions. All of those things go on. So it's one of the things you have to do. It's also what you have to do for a landscape. Because, one of the things that environmental historians do is we don't just read humans that way. We read the landscape. When we move through the landscape, we see not just what's there now. We're always looking for what had been there before, of a different world which has vanished but not fully vanished. And so the two things are really parallel to me. I can move back and forth between conventional history and environmental history because it's the same set of skills, the same attitude, the same perspective on the world.
How does the way you interact with a landscape change when you see it as this changing three-dimensional
Because what it realizes, what you're there is not some internal verity, that you're not seeing something that this is the way it is, the way it always has been, and the way it always has to be. You see it more like you see human beings. You see something as having come to life at one time, going through a series of changes, and someday will vanish. You value it very, very fully, but you don't take it as this sort of eternal past, that it's the earth, too, changes. Now, this is... The speed of change is what matters. I mean, we're in a time where the planet seems to be changing much more quickly than ever before. But even when I think about that, I think about, well, there's been periods that are rare, the extinction of the dinosaurs, asteroids hitting the Earth, volcanic eruptions, the way in which carbon dioxide and oxygen first come into the atmosphere, that all of this has been this long process of change. What's so interesting about the present is we have speeded this up in a way that rarely has been seen seen before in the planet's history. But nothing's new, but the speed is astonishing.
Right. And so how should that impact the way that we behave in response to these changes?
Well, it's one of the things is that I think for a long time for human beings, they could imagine the world they operated in was going to be pretty much the same world their grandchildren operated in and their great-grandchildren are going to operate in and the ones that their grandparents had operated in.
Isn't that just a misunderstanding? Or
well, it wasn't changing at the same pace. I mean, one of the things you think about, the United States, American history, we've altered this continent. It took us, a couple of centuries to really start making massive changes over the whole thing. Now we can do that kind of stuff in a generation. So, yeah, you're perfectly right. I mean, one of the things environmental history teaches you is change has been a constant. What we're having to deal is what difference does it make when, in fact, the speed of that change and the sweep of that change is greater than ever before? And I'm torn. I'm torn between thinking, well, this really is not that different from what human beings have seen before, to thinking, well, the scale of it, the speed of it, the sweep of it makes it qualitatively different. And I haven't reached an opinion yet about where I – some days I stay in one place, some days another place.
You also said in your interview with David Kennedy that you're not a happy-faced historian and you will never be.
No.
Does that translate into kind of your outlook on the future and your – kind of hope for
us? No, oddly enough, this always astonishes my friends when I say it, is I think of myself as pretty much an optimistic person because, and the reason for my optimism, if I was pessimistic and cynical, who would care? I mean, the whole reason that, in fact, I tend to be critical or I tend to demand change or think things are going on because I think we can do it. I think, in fact, the world could be a far better place than the one that we make it, and I think a whole lot of things we can do better. And to me, to believe that, you have to be essentially optimistic because otherwise, to be totally cynical, this is the way it is. It's always going to be that way. There's nothing you can do about it, so forget it. And I've never, ever thought that. But in the stories I write, I'm certainly not happy face. I mean, there's a kind of history which I know sells more books. So I sell plenty of books. That's fine. But I could sell a lot more books if I could have happy endings, if in fact, and I could have heroic figures who pretty much people can identify with and overcome everything. My books don't end that way.
Maybe that's why you sell more, because they're more controversial or something?
If you look at a certain kind of, a certain kind of best-selling history, it's going to be the kind of Stephen Ambrose, Lewis and Clark kind of thing. If I ended up telling the Lewis and Clark story, it would end with Meriwether Lewis's suicide and Clark's stuff. And that comes in there, but the real story for Ambrose is the triumph of getting across the trail. And I don't think it's because I'm dark. It's just because I think that's what attracts me is both the lights and shadows of human life. And what attracts me is studying things that are really problems. If people want to write about the happy parts, there are plenty of historians who can do the happy parts.
Do you think yours is a more honest portrayal of the facts?
No, it's what we choose to write about. I choose to write about things that most people would rather not talk about. The Transcontinental Railroads, for example, were doing just fine. They ended a promontory summit. They drove the spike. It was a technological triumph. Why in the world do I have to write a book saying that they're failures with all kinds of environmental and social damage and that they shouldn't have been built for another 40 or 50 years after they were built? Why can't I just leave well enough alone? It's a good question, I guess.
Is it important not to leave him alone, though, because that's what happened?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, in fact, once you do that, you end up doing these things over and over again because you peel away all of the bad part.
And so I guess we were just talking about the impact of ourselves today and our increasing impact on the planet. And in thinking of the Anthropocene, we're deciding whether this should be a new geologic era. And I know it's like this back and forth of, well, what does this new impact mean?
Well, I mean, what's distinctive now is that with global warming, it covers the whole globe all at once for the same basic kind of cause. And that, I think, is new. But in the terms of human impact on the environment, fire takes longer. It operates differently on different continents. It really doesn't work very well in the Antarctic, where you're not going to get much fire. But at the same time, it's something which transforms the environment. It's the kind of stuff from studying Australia. So fire has been a human tool that's transformed the environment. When I also think about the pandemics that swept over the world, something like the virgin soil epidemics in North America led to a population decline unrivaled in human history. I mean, the depopulation of North America, the death of over 90%, probably more, of native peoples living in North America. So there have been transformations that have been absolutely astonishing in scale. But they've tended to be continental in scale, or they've tended to take centuries. This one is unfolding relatively quickly. It begins in the 19th century, but its impact is on us now, and it affects every place all at once. So it's not the effect. We've had great effects on the environment before, and it's not even the damage. We've really done damage before. But this one is that it's happening everywhere at once from one basic set of causes is what sets it apart. Whether to separate that out from other eras, I'm not sure.
Would you draw the line? Where would you draw the line?
Well, it's very difficult to do because at some days I would say, let's say we're going to consider global warming, the beginning of humans dominating a geological age. Well, do you start it when we first start burning coal, even though nobody's really recognized it until later? Do you do it when, in fact, you have a certain degree of temperature change? I mean, if you're going to say that, well, geological eras, where do you mark the beginning? Has it begun yet? Or did it begin 100 years ago, but we didn't know it? If you're going to say it's human influence over the environment, where, in fact, humans are a huge factor, then I think you have to go back a long, long way to when human beings start using fire and start reshaping the world, domesticating animals, bringing about extinctions. All of those things are clearly human impacts. And the other part is, we are now certainly the most powerful beings on the planet in terms of influencing change, but we're still beings who are very much subject to natural powers. Every time there's an earthquake, every time a volcano explodes, every time there's a tsunami, all of these things which we didn't cause and can't control, those things remind us we're powerful, but there are deep geological forces we don't control and which really can change things very, very quickly.
Does that change the fact that perhaps this should be a new era, maybe beginning at the Industrial Revolution or whenever those whenever humanity gained that like number one role in terms of impactors of the environment?
It's hard to say. I mean, in the sense that let's say that if the real thing was, are you going to go back to bacteria that began to produce the Earth's atmosphere? Because you can make a case that where's the first species that really transform everything? The argument would be it's the production of the atmosphere. It's the production of oxygen. It's carbon dioxide, all of which begins before there's a human being on the planet, which is as profound as anything we're doing now. It seems to me sometimes we're doing apples and oranges, that there's a set of forces deep in the planet which we call geology. And now we're adding human beings for another set of forces, which in some ways are quite distinct. They can have consequences just as great, but whether we then identify them with these deep geological forces, I don't know. I mean, there's something in the historian in me saying, well, these are, you know, all you're doing is they're both consequential. They both change the terms of life. So therefore, you're saying they're the same. But I think we might be masking as much as gaining by putting them together. But as I say, it's a question I still think about. It's a very, very interesting one. And I haven't reached a firm conclusion on it yet.
And so for you, it's just you haven't decided yet what merits that.
Well, whether, in fact, describing that change, if we're going to really cause it, if we're going to call it a geological age, if we're going to call it the Anthropocene, that seems to be identifying it with all kinds of other, it's like the Pleistocene or something else, where it still seems an apples and oranges kind of thing to me. It's not that, in fact, both aren't describing real differences, but there is a difference for a historian that when human actions simply become the equivalent of geological actions, then I step back because, it's not the way I understand human history.
It's not the way because, like when you say apples and oranges, it's because humans should be not identified with these geologic forces, or?
No, because I think, in fact, what humans are identified is a kind of change that I'd resist calling a geological force.
Okay.
Because what's happening is a set of things that we've done. I mean, if you could do a thought experiment. Let's say, in fact, that we arrest global warming, or in fact that we accelerate it so much that we're wiped out, and that the Earth fairly quickly reverts back to a different kind of climate. The episode which you're calling the Anthropocene is not something that lasts millions of years. It's now something that lasts maybe hundreds of years or 1,000 years, which all the other epochs we're talking about are these vast sweeps of time. But now we've taken this tiny little one, which you might not even be able to recognize years and years from now from the actual record, and equating them with those. I'm not sure. When you have ages that run for millions of years and you have something which has been going on for a century, if you're going to equate it with climate change, are those really equivalents? And when can you can't even tell when it really begins. That's the point which seems to me apples and oranges.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Richard, for being here.
Okay. Thank you, Judy.
What do you want people to take away from that interview?
I think especially a conversation like that with Richard White gives people a lot of ways to reflect on their previous interactions with nature, especially, and I forget what a mind-blowing piece of information it was when I first kind of read The Trouble with Wilderness by William Cronin and realized, oh, wow, like there are these parks out there. And that's not the way that maybe is best to conceive of nature. Nature is everywhere. The house I live in is part of nature. And I think that's a really important takeaway.
You know, I've listened to the interview several times, and here's what I think about that I'm still wrestling with is, okay, we do need to take a more active and responsible role in our intervention with natural landscapes or with any interaction with nature. But if we then sort of take his premise as there's no such thing as a separate other nature, I don't know how that then becomes useful. I don't know. I guess it makes us see the world in a different way and we go from there, but it makes environmental activism a lot more complicated.
Well, it at least makes it not into a, these are the natural places that you need to protect and that you need to monitor your interaction with. It means that every single place that you are, you need to think about, how am I impacting this environment? And this is also something I need to protect. Even the little tree that is like planted in cement on the sidewalk somewhere, like that's a natural thing. And even the cement, that came from somewhere, you know?
Yeah,
so
no,
all these things are places where you need to monitor your interaction, not just this. Don't leave your candy wrapper in the middle of Yosemite type thing.
Right. Well, Judy, thanks so much for coming in, and excellent job on your interview.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?